Welcome back everyone to this Friday edition of the Damage Report. Thank God it's Friday. Hey Brett, how's it going?
Oh my God, it's so great to be here. I'm near you. Mm-hmm. That makes my life perfect.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a gigantic news week, so it's gonna be sad to see it go.
It's such a weird news week, you're right.
It was a very weird news week. I'm personally very happy. Did you know that coming up September 9th, Congress is back in session? I'm actually kind of excited for that because I want them to be doing something. Because so far it's been a lot of executive branch. I need some balance.
Yep, I need more branches.
Yeah, I need a little bit more branch to balance it out.
To climb onto.
It's been some kind of week. And so look, we're gonna take stock on a couple of the big stories of the week, but we also have some new stuff too. News for the Republican primary in this presidential cycle. We've got a congressional candidate who's gonna join us. We've got an upcoming movie intended to appeal to right-wing Christians. Mm-hmm. We're gonna do a little preview of that movie, give
this
our impressions.
Herculean effort.
It's a Herculean effort.
To bring them to the box office.
Spoiler alert, disappointed. But anyway, we're also gonna talk about SNL. Did they get Donald Trump elected in 2016? And what are they gonna do to us this time around? But anyway, lots to get to. So why don't we just jump right into it with the primary. Donald Trump already has multiple declared primary opponents in this Republican presidential cycle, but they might not be coming to a state near you because multiple Republican state parties, this is South Carolina, Nevada, Arizona, and Kansas, are already expecting to finalize a process that will cancel their primaries and caucuses. And so even though there are multiple choices on the Republican side or multiple who might qualify, there is not going to be a choice in those states. And those cancellations stem in part from months of behind the scenes maneuvering by the Trump campaign, with aides working to ensure total control of the party machinery, installing staunch loyalists at state parties while eliminating potential detractors. The aim, Trump officials have long said, is to smooth the path to the president's renomination and ensure he doesn't face the kind of internal opposition that hampered former President George H.W. Bush in his failed 1992 re-election campaign. Trump aides say that they have supported the cancellations, but stress that each case was initiated by state party officials.
Mm.
So we're very happy about this. But like that, Joe did that.
Joe wasn't great. It wasn't my systematic dismantling of any potential opposition that could exist. It was just Joe showed up.
Mm-hmm.
Pa-pow! Now there is no primary.
You know, sometimes you're just no in opposition. Sync with another person.
It's a smart move. It's mm-hmm. good work if you can get it. It mm-hmm. kind of is counter to the democratic process. But this is it. I mean, this is one of those things that, like, the way that the party apparatuses are set up is that they are supposed to, in many ways, work as a counterbalance to runaway public opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And so they just need to hit this sweet spot of like being like, are we sure we want to do this? But not too much of like, hey, we're going to cancel primaries so you can't oppose us.
Mm-hmm.
To me, if this happened in the Democratic Party, like, people would lose it the way they lost it last mm-hmm. time when it was revealed that like the superdelegate count was out of control.
Mm-hmm. Well, here's the thing. So I'm not ready to say that it has happened to the extent that it is looking like it will happen this time around. But one of the reasons that like all the headlines this morning are, and this isn't necessarily wrong. All the headlines are GOP defending soft Trump reelection or something like that. It's like, oh God, he might not win. He might get taken down by Joe Walsh, so let's cancel the primaries. I don't think that that's likely to happen, but also they are right when they come out and say that some other primaries and caucuses have been canceled before. And I've read a bunch of articles. I was trying to find systematically how many there have been, and there doesn't seem to be much centralized information about this. But there was one state, let's see, so South Carolina skipped its 1996 and 2012 Democratic contests. Let's see, South Carolina also didn't do one in 1984 for Ronald Reagan. It seems like South Carolina just doesn't like holding elections. But so it has technically happened before. It's just gonna be interesting to see, is it a case where it's like one state isn't, you know, up for it? Or is it 20 states are not gonna have caucuses?
We'll see what happens. Of the ones that are in this conversation, we got South Carolina, Nevada, Arizona, and Kansas. He won three of those already.
Mm-hmm.
He lost Kansas?
Mm-hmm.
To Marco Rubio, I think.
Really?
I think it was
wow.
Rubio. But he lost Kansas.
Marco.
He lost that one. Mm-hmm. He won Nevada. Nevada is the one that's like kind of the bellwether. It's an early state. It is proportional, so it's not like winner take all. And so he won for like 14 of those delegates, and I think Rubio, who was the second in whoever the second finisher was, won like 7. But what they want is a very streamlined path for their new leader. And it's pretty funny because a lot of this is in reaction to like what they had with Barry Goldwater, who was like actually very similar in many ways to Trump. When Barry Goldwater won the nomination for the Republicans, it ended up being like a ridiculously embarrassing landslide. It was one of those things where they looked at it and said, the Republican Party let its stupid voters choose this time. And the stupid voters chose a crazy like populist demagogue who ended up costing us big. But now the crazy populist demagogue is their entire party identity, and it ended up winning them the election. It's actually funny because like the Democrats are the ones who typically, historically, are the ones who let their party apparatus run wild and do way too much in terms of controlling who gets the nomination.
Yeah.
It resulted in like riots in Chicago in the 60s and the giant, you know, FUBAR situation with Debbie Wasserman Schultz, superdelegates, and Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, no, thankfully the superdelegates there has been reformed there. They're not totally gone, but it should be less of a concern. We'll have to see the biggest effect that it's ever had. Because remember, the superdelegates have never actually swung an election. But the media reporting on it long before they ever have any influence, before any votes are cast, that could still happen.
And those are similar tactics. To say that, to have superdelegates essentially be predetermined in terms of who they are going to vote for allows the media to point to a scoreboard and say like, no, Hillary's already got this.
Yeah, exactly.
You don't, and it's a version of you don't need to hold this election. Yeah. It's already in the bag.
Exactly.
It's just this move by the GOP is way more explicit.
Yeah, the thing that's weird about this though is, so we've got some quotes from Joe Walsh and Bill Weld about how frustrated they are about this. We'll see if we get to it, I don't really care. but it's like, you're not gonna, you might not even get on some of these. Bill Weld probably will, but Joe Walsh isn't even gonna get on some of the ballots, if there were ballots to be gotten on. And even if you had the contests, one important thing to bear in mind, a difference between Republican primaries, or the primary process, because it includes caucuses too, and the Democratic side is, and this is not universal, but for the most part, Democratic contests are proportional, and Republican contests are winner take all. Which means that if Joe Walsh comes in and gets 5 or 10 or 15% of the vote, that means nothing. It means nothing in most of these states. It doesn't take away one vote from Donald Trump. You could say, look, he got a percentage, maybe that'll get some bad media for Trump, but it doesn't actually hurt his numbers in terms of getting elected.
But they just want to tell Walsh and Weld to go away. And they want to quash any potential reason they can, way they can justify sticking around. So they're saying, what are you going to do? You're going to run in what contest? We're not having contests.
Yeah.
Why are you here?
Yeah, you should definitely have the primaries. You should definitely have the caucuses. If you're president, you should be confident that you can win one of these. But if they had them, I don't think that he would lose.
What happened to heavy vetting, man?
Exactly.
The Republicans aren't going to vet anyone.
Exactly.
They should have, if he's so strong, that's the thing, is this is just sounds, this is a way to seem strong that is actually quite weak.
Exactly.
This is the weakest you can possibly be. This is someone saying,
no, it can get just slightly weaker, which it probably will tomorrow or the next day when all of this reporting, and it's been all over the place, Donald Trump tweets about it. And claims that it's not happening, and it's not to protect him.
But the truth is, it is so weak when two people who you say you're so much stronger than say, hey, let's play. Let's go, let's take it to the park right now and, you know, shoot some hoops.
Yeah.
And you're like, no, I can't. Listen, the ref said the game can't happen.
Park's been canceled.
Yeah, park got canceled.
Exactly. Okay, so we're gonna take a short break. We come back, candidate's gonna be joining us.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be. Featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Joining us now, congressional candidate for New York's 12th District, Erica Vladimir. Welcome to the Damage Report.
Thank you so much for having me, John.
It's great to have you here. This is the first time that you've been on the show. And generally, the first time we talk to a candidate, we want to get to know them a little bit. We have a lot of candidates in this cycle who have not run for public office before. You have not, but you have worked in government, correct?
That's correct. I worked for the New York State Senate, and then I also worked for New York City's Independent Budget Office.
So how would you say that influences you now running for office?
I think it's a huge influence. As someone who has a perspective and understands what happens on the inside of closed doors, I know firsthand how government continually shuts out the very voices that need to be at the table. And if general people saw how laws are negotiated and drafted, I really think that they would be horrified. And it's time to change that system.
And in particular, over the past few years, we've learned a lot about New York state politics, and it really does, it's had a reputation, obviously, for a very long time of having party machines and corruption, things like that, and it certainly does seem to be that way. Do you think that having some experiencing, witnessing that might inform, if you become a congressperson, the sort of corruption and that sort of thing that we see at the national level?
Yeah, and I think not only witnessing corruption and rampant abuse and harassment and discrimination, but also my experience as an advocate in helping reform those and to overhaul the New York State human rights laws to increase those protections. And there's still a lot of work to be done, but I saw how advocates, when they start pounding on that door and saying, "We are not going to go away," and being able to have partners on the inside from a new generation of elected officials, putting all of that together is how we're going to get the reform that we need, not just here in New York State, but also in Congress.
And so what about your platform? What are some of the issues that you're going to be stressing during this run?
I am certainly going to be stressing education. Education policy is why I went to law school. It's why I wanted to work in New York State government and also what I worked on when I was working for the city. I think we need to fully fund the Individuals with Disability Education Act. We need to ensure that everybody gets access to a free, appropriate public education. And I also think we need to increase Title I-A funding, which is one of the biggest funding streams for public schools from the federal government. And then, of course, I'll also be fighting for the same workplace protections against harassment and discrimination that I fought for here on the state level in Congress.
And I definitely want to return to that topic in just a moment. But first, this is a primary field that already, as a lot of New York ones are, has multiple candidates in it, including one who's the current incumbent, Carolyn Maloney, who's held onto the seat effectively for 14 terms. So very long lasting incumbent. How does that influence your race going up against someone who is well known in the area?
I think the fact that she has been there for so long is indicative of why we need new representation and why we need new leadership here in New York 12 and also across the country in various congressional districts. We need new, fresh perspectives that are actually going to embody and illustrate where society is going, what it means to be an inclusive, compassionate community. And we're going to need new voices to do that.
I certainly couldn't agree more. In this particular case, though, with Carolyn Maloney, what would you say are some of the biggest policy distinctions between yourself and the incumbent?
I think what we would be focusing on is certainly different. As a Congress member, I would be focusing on education and reinvesting in education. I would also be looking just to take what we have seen on the congressional level farther steps and really pushing for that bold reform, and also pushing against leadership, because that's not what we're seeing from our current representation. We have representatives who are really comfortable in their seats. The status quo has benefited them for so long, and they're worried about keeping those seats. We need a representative who is going to be bold, who is willing to put themselves out there for the marginalized communities that have not had a seat at the table for far too long. And this includes communities like sex workers. And so they deserve a seat at the table when we are talking about decriminalizing sex work, not just on a state, but a national level. We haven't been seeing this bold leadership from our current representation.
So let's turn now to the work that you did after you resigned from government service back in 2015. You formed an organization. Can you tell us about that experience?
Sure. So I am a co-founder, although no longer a member, of the Sexual Harassment Working Group. And we are eight former legislative staffers, all who either experienced harassment, assault, discrimination, or retaliation at the hands of elected and appointed officials. We were the voices that were shut out from the very process, from the very policies that our elected officials were trying to advance on behalf of us in our name. And yet they wouldn't listen to why we believed that these laws that they were looking to pass would not have helped us in our current circumstances. And so by working together based off our own experiences, by working with advocates who have been fighting for these workplace protections against harassment and discrimination for years, we really did some strong coalition building. And we had amazing partners on the inside, again, from new, fresh perspectives, from a new generation of elected officials that was really driven by thoughtful, ambitious women. And together we were able to overhaul the state human rights law in 1 year, which is unheard of in New York State.
You know, I think back to when the Me Too movement was ramping up and there was this sort of reckoning in multiple different industries. And I remember hearing some like whispers about this sort of thing happening in Congress. There was some implications from some serving politicians about experiences they'd had. And it really feels like now in hindsight, aside from one or two standout cases, that we didn't really learn that much. And it doesn't seem like there was that much reform, considering what it seemed like was a lot of evidence that something was going on there. If you get elected, do you see yourself continuing the work that you've done previously in that organization inside of the House, inside of Congress?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think we need to strengthen workplace protections against harassment and discrimination on a national level. I would certainly be focusing inside Congress, inside the House itself. We need to reform the rules. We need to, you know, continue to strengthen the Congressional Accountability Act. We need to close loopholes like the one in Title VII that right now allows state entities to say that certain legislative staffers are not actually employees of the state. We just saw that here in the New York Times. It was written about today. And so there's definitely a lot to be done on the federal level, but also inside Congress. And I will certainly be, you know, leading that and working with those who have experienced harassment and discrimination.
Oh, I think it's been a long time coming. Erica Vladimir, a congressional candidate for New York's 12th district. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We're going to take a short break here. We come back, lots more to get to. Okay, so I just want to look back briefly on the news of the week, and that was Sharpiegate. I think the most detached from reality a politician has been and forced everyone else to become. But this is much less about the individual Sharpiegate story and more about a trend in government where Donald Trump's lack of willingness to accept that he was wrong doesn't just mean that he comes off as a little bit crazy, but that actually means that the government is dispatched to support him. So just really fast, let's just finish up with Sharpiegate, where Donald Trump sharpied on a marker to imply that Alabama was going to be hit by Hurricane Dorian. So anonymous White House official tells Washington Post that it was Donald Trump that did the sharpieing, surprising everyone. Of course it was him. And by the way, I don't know for sure that it wasn't already for sale, but they're selling thin markers on his campaign website, which seems to be an acknowledgement.
And all those, and just think for a minute about all those shots that you got from NBC News that showed that the president took the notes he had for some kind of speech and marked over the top in like a thick Sharpie marker. Like the guy uses Sharpies on everything.
Maybe it's bad eyes.
And that's
it.
And that's just the kind of Kool-Aid man burst through reality approach the president has had since the beginning. I'm just going to make it this way. Marky, sharper marking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was how we found out about the fact that he thinks that the greatest terrorist threat to the US is spelled A-L-C-A-I-D-A.
Yeah.
We just glossed over. It's just okay. Yeah, he thinks Al-Qaeda is spelled that way. Mm-hmm. But anyway, look, so it was definitely him. If you're a Trump supporter, to me, you either pass the Sharpie test or you don't. You either can acknowledge that that is really weird. And if I found out that Brett had Sharpied an image to lie to make himself seem right, I would think about that for the rest of the time that I knew Brett. That would be a really weird thing for the president to do in an official, like that either bothers you or just stop pretending that you care about anything.
That's like,
literally.
You know, there was some cartoon I saw back in the day where the person got an F. Mm-hmm. And then like drew down a line at the end of the F to make it a very
boxy
A.
Well, the Simpsons, they did that for a report card.
So yeah, for a report card, that's what it was.
Yeah.
And that's what this is. Mm-hmm. And let's go into the psychology. Let's go into the psychology of who would support that. There's someone who has other priorities, mm-hmm. so they don't care. Mm-hmm. So long as and that's the tax cut Republican who says, mm-hmm. I know he's insane. I really don't care. For now,
that's fine.
It works for me. That's not fine. That's
insane.
Terrible. No. But they're not going to acknowledge. None of these people are acknowledging it outright. They're lying about it. Like Lou Dobbs.
Yeah.
Lou Dobbs is the kind of person. Sean Hannity is the one who knows better. But then there's other people who like that mentality. They want things to be true and they like to just say falsehoods and have other people believe them. And it's a deeper level of like quasi-psychosis, and psychosis is divorcing yourself from reality. Mm-hmm. It's not clinically the same thing, but that general dynamic applies where you're just like, if I had my druthers, I would change reality to be more in line with all my other druthers.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's happening, and that's who the presidents and those are people who like a winner.
Yeah,
they don't realize that the winner in this case is acting like an utter loser.
Yeah,
by just drawing on a map, mm-hmm. which is a crime to doctor a National Weather Service forecast. Like, imagine the Weather Service being like, Alabama, listen, calm down. It's not actually coming for you.
Well, they said that.
Your president has lost their mind.
I'm just glad that he did it this way, because it's one thing to just double down, triple down, quadruple down on you being wrong or whatever. But in particular, like, if I could, considering how little respect I have for him, if I could have him do one thing, it would be for him to like pick up a crayon or a marker and just start scribbling on things. And that's what he did.
Yeah.
Anyway, look, there are many of you out there who don't care, fine. You think that it's weird to focus on the fact that the president has no connection to reality. I personally think that's very important. But let me try to make one last appeal to you, and that is that even if you don't care about Sharpiegate, you don't care about the fact that he had a rear admiral take the fall for him, that you don't care that he potentially broke the law, fine. Over the course of his presidency, in many cases, he has said something that is not true, and to cover for him, to make him feel better, the US government has had to expend resources and money and time to try to make him feel better himself. And I want to run through a couple of the greatest hits or misses. So obviously he cares a lot about the wall. He wants you to be scared about what's coming across the wall. And so at one point, an official US government document was put out. Let's take an image. You're gonna see some really scary statistics there. So look at that number in the middle. 3,755 known or suspected terrorists prevented from traveling to or entering the US. So Trump had been talking about terrorists coming across the southern border. And so it became a thing where in these official documents, in multiple interviews that Sarah Huckabee Sanders did, they parroted that number. That number doesn't mean anything like what they're implying it means. It does not mean that these are terrorists. It means these are people coming from countries where a terrorist has come from. And those people are not coming across the southern border. Those people were apprehended or at least talked to, because again, they haven't broken any laws. They were talked to in airports. And yet Sarah Huckabee Sanders multiple times trotted out that fake statistic. Chris Wallace had to take her to task on Fox News over.
Not Chris Wallace.
Yes, he did. So there was that. Even more particular and sort of ridiculous is, you might remember him telling this story over and over about the fact that cars were being stopped driving across the southern border out in the desert with women duct taped in the back seat. He just kept saying that over and over again. And so that's weird. Weirder though is the Border Patrol doing work to try to make you seem right. So this was an email sent out by Armando Sanchez, acting assistant chief of the US Border Patrol, that asked everyone in the agency to forward any information that you may have in any format regarding those claims. So if you have anything, if anything in this article rings a bell, please give it to us, because we need this for Trump, because nobody knows what he's talking about. And so that was what the Border Patrol was tasked with for some time. Let's see, in other areas. So Jim Acosta, they suspended his press credentials, and to explain why they needed to do that, do you remember, let's take a look at the screenshot. You remember Speed Up Gate? So this was where they sped up video, and Sarah Huckabee Sanders tweeted this out, to make it look like he was karate chopping a female intern, when in fact he was doing no such thing. This was so that they could not have Jim Acosta bothering them in press briefings back when those happened.
Yes.
I have others, but feel free to jump in.
It's just like, there's the normalization argument. He is normalizing the abnormal, which happens all the time. That's how things become norms. Mm-hmm. They weren't normal, and then we did them enough, and now they're normal. But the question is, what kind of abnormal is bad? Mm-hmm. And this kind of abnormal is bad, because we can't trust anything. Mm-hmm. We can't, and
even
we have
video.
Proof. The thing is, we absolutely have proof that they are lying about things. We present it, and nothing happened.
We literally played that video showing side by side the actual video and the sped up video, and Republicans were like, "What name? So this doesn't look like anything to me."
Yeah, it doesn't look like anything to me.
It's two videos playing side by side. Anyway, super
then
fast. Just to
West
give you an idea
world,
of how many different areas.
World.
Exactly. So back before the midterms, he said that middle income Americans are going to get a 10% tax cut before the midterm elections to boost his numbers. Nobody in government knew what he was talking about. And Congress wasn't in session, so no legislation could actually be passed. So administration officials considered a symbolic non-binding resolution to signal to voters that someday, if the Republicans hold on to the House, they could get that. But he just said, he didn't say like someday or we're gonna try. He's saying you're getting a 10% tax cut. And that meant that then government just had to be, okay, let's come up with something. Let's try to pretend that this is the truth, and it's not. Like, obviously, I mean, he started his presidency with this image, the inaugurations. He pressured Park Service to find photos that to make it look like he had more people at his inauguration. So this goes way back to the very beginning.
This is what dictators do.
Exactly.
This is in line with Kim Jong-un has gotten 18 holes in one while playing golf.
Mm-hmm. And that's impressive.
It. It's really impressive.
Yeah.
And if you can make that reality, it's super awesome for you.
Sharpie the hole. But here's why it's worrisome. And here's why I think it's worth focusing on. So it's one thing to Sharpie, you know, a map because the hurricane didn't go where you wanted it to or thought that it might or whatever. But what about when he sets up official inquisitions for much more consequential stuff, like the results of elections? So after the 2016 election, which he won, even though he won, he still claimed that millions of votes had been cast illegally, and they set up a voter fraud commission that had multiple meetings. It was a sham to begin with. That was how he reacted to an election that he won. If he can't accept that Alabama wasn't hit by a hurricane or wasn't gonna be hit by a hurricane, what if he lost the election? You know, what if it was a couple electoral votes, the difference between him winning and losing? What if Wisconsin had gone the other way, and instead of him winning by 18,000 votes, he lost by 18,000 votes? If he can't accept that he's wrong about weather, What makes you think he'd accept that he was wrong about the results of his reelection bid?
Now, here's one way to move on that intelligence, that question anyways, that rhetorical setup, is to just get everyone you know to vote. Like, honestly, stop what you're doing around the presidential election and actually hit the turf and get people to vote, because this is horrible. Like, we're all like numbed to it. And we can normalize crazy things all the time. We're fine with giraffes. It's a giant horse whose neck is 15 feet long. And we're fine with it. We have a giraffe president. We're just like, oh, that just is how it is. It's as ridiculous as a giraffe being president.
I'd take it.
You know what I mean?
I'd take it.
I think we should do a primal scream.
You want to?
But like an ad, right, like now, a choreograph. What do you think? We should talk about this off camera and coordinate. And I want people to send you tweets because you're better at Twitter than me. But like, should we do a primal scream where we all send out like a script to everyone, and at this at like 10 p.m., everyone opens their window
and
shouts the same thing out the window at the same time,
like that college in Germany.
Perhaps we used to do it in that. College during finals week.
That's true. Anyway, look, I want to give credit to Greg Sargent of the Washington Post for collecting some of these instances that you might remember. I know that it seems like a stupid story, but I do think that it says something important about his psychology and potentially the future of our government. Okay, we're going to take a short break. We come back, far less important news. Kevin Sorbo is back. If you've been missing him since the Hercules days, he has a movie coming out that we have some thoughts about. It's The Reliant. Here's some of the trailer.
National Guard and local responders are overwhelmed in the bigger metropolitan areas.
Maybe we're overreacting.
That was in our neighborhood.
Get everyone in the car.
Catch my office now.
The whole town's on fire. The police are retreating. We have prepared for this. We will survive.
You don't know what it's like out there.
Every little family dream, 3 meals a day, it's over.
Okay, so a lot of the media coverage of this is pitching it as like it's a right-wing fantasy about Antifa out of control and someone having to fight them off. And from that trailer, I get it. They're really playing up the like, that doesn't that look like Antifa or whatever? I don't think that's actually what's going on, but I'm curious about your reaction.
Listen, much of my 4 to 5 p.m. weekday schedule when I was in middle school / high school was dedicated to Hercules, the Legendary Journeys. So I blindly support the Sorb.
Yes. And Andromeda, I think he was in. That was good.
How does he need to be in other stuff besides Hercules for you to like him?
Well, no, he wants to keep working.
No.
I get that.
He and Aeolus really handed it to the Hydra.
Oh, I forgot about Aeolus.
Anyway, so
That's
Xena. They gave rise to Xena.
She's still good.
And lawlessness.
That's true. Yes.
Back
something
to,
something Gabrielle. Yeah, okay, yeah. We've covered all of them.
Hi.
So anyway, let's talk about this. Here's the thing. Let's talk about the synopsis. Let's get an idea of what this really is, because it's a movie based off of a book, and I want to understand it, because this is targeted, obviously, at both right-wingers and also Christians. You don't get much of that from the trailer, but it very much is. So let's talk about the synopsis. Alone and vulnerable, the children's faith and family bonds are pushed to the limit, especially those of the eldest daughter, Sophie, who questions the morality of gun ownership, but soon learns that in God all things are good, including her family's Second Amendment right to defend themselves. It is now up to the children to reclaim their home, find their parents, and put an end to Jack's rampage. So you get an idea of what they're going for here.
Yeah, it's like you ever see a trailer for a movie and you're like, that looks fine, I guess I'll see it. I'm bored and I need explosions because it's summer. And then you go and you're like, this is nothing like the trailer. That's the difference between the synopsis. It's like, what was the Wolf movie with Liam Neeson where it was like, oh, it's just
the
a Wolf movie. The Gray, the fuck. You just go and you're like, this is not the same.
Yeah. Or there was that Cuba Gooding Jr. movie with the talking dogs, but that was just like a 6 second dream sequence.
Exactly, so that's That's the difference. What we've just landed on here is what's so weird about the Sorbo thing. And it's this specific genre of television actor who has found an audience with the super Christian zone. It is the Kirk Cameron part two.
Yes, it is.
Where I love the idea of the Second Amendment being like the central thrust. It's a way to say, hey, conservative America, here is a movie you can see. Mm-hmm. It is okay. It has all the action stuff you like, but none of that like gay Hollywood world in it.
Yeah.
It's safe now.
And look, I think you can make whatever movie you want. And I think that every audience deserves movies made for it. I do just think it's a little bit weird to spend 90% of your time saying that Hollywood is indoctrinating the country and 10% of your time making a movie that is the most obvious right-wing propaganda I've ever seen in film, I think.
I just don't understand this line. Questions the morality of gun ownership, but soon learns that in God, all things are good. Well, can't...
It's not very specific.
In God, can't not owning a gun be good?
Like, that's the only thing that can't.
So God makes the guns? Is that what's happening? Doesn't he have laser fingers?
He does not. So look, I want to show a little bit more of the trailer because they get into the God thing in a particular way that a lot of movies get something wrong. You'll see it in this clip.
What's it like out there?
It's chaos.
The weapons in the safe now.
Sophie, go! Go, get out of here!
God has forsaken us!
Timmy!
Leave me alone, Sophie! Leave me alone!
Timmy!
He deserves to die! Who is responsible for it? Huh? Who's responsible? You know who? God is! God is responsible!
Just, okay, so there's a
lot.
Things.
There's a lot. First of all, the Boz. The Boz is in it. Barry Bosworth is in it. Eric Roberts, I think, magically in it.
Yeah, so at the end there was a quote from a movie director. Do you know what movie that movie director directed?
Oh, I can't wait. What?
That movie.
No!
That
I was wondering.
Movie.
So yeah, for those listening to the podcast,
he was the director for the movie.
Throughout the trailer, they keep showing like little reviews, but the reviews like normally you'll see like, you know, this A.O. Scott from the New York Times or like, you know, the Hollywood Reporter movie. No, it just said Ben B.
Yeah.
D self.
Well, and it was by the way.
And the last one was just this guy, comma movie director,
which
not this movie's director.
If you're the director, you should like it. I got nothing against that. It's weird to put it in the thing though. And look, most of those.
I was awesome. Barry Bosworth.
Great directing. So look, most of those quotes were from people who clearly hadn't seen the movie yet. They had read a script. It talks about it being a page turner. And look, I looked up the book. So the book is by Patrick Johnston. The Amazon reviews seem very positive. Like, and look, you can write for whatever audience. Again, I got nothing against your audience.
But it's not like Angels and Demons. It's not like a kind of religious invoking book that reached widespread popularity. This is a book that only the community that would like it finds out about.
Probably, especially because it's only going to be in theaters for one night on October 24th in selected theaters. So I feel bad for Kevin Sorbo in that particular respect. My thing is, again, like first of all, it was called eerily prophetic in one of those quotes because of what, Antifa? So this movie was initially Kickstarter Indiegogo in 2016. None of them were thinking about Antifa there. And Antifa has not invaded and rampaged with guns. The people with guns are the ones they're protesting against. So it's just really weird to fantasize that like, oh, this person was right. That's what's actually going on. It's not what's going on. It is a fundamental lie about the opposition to fascism in this country. That's my problem. My problem's not with making the movie. My problem isn't even with the movie looking bad. It's a guy's passion project. He raised money, he made the movie. It looks way better than any movie I could ever make. I'll give him that.
I definitely want to see it.
It's lying about a movement.
Yeah.
And that's not even really on the director because again, Antifa wasn't even a thing people were talking about back then. It's the right wingers using this movie to besmirch people who don't want to see fascism take over America.
But come see it with me and John. We're gonna go see it. Let's all go together. Maybe we'll stream it in his backyard.
If it's in LA, I'll see it.
I'll go with you.
Okay, come on.
Were we?
Okay,
we're gonna do it. Human interaction.
Okay. Anyway, we gotta take a break. We come back more, but this time TV. Did SNL get Donald Trump elected in 2016? That is a possible, could be. Anthony Jeselnik, comedian, thinks that SNL, in allowing Donald Trump to come on, was irresponsible and helped to normalize him. But there were a few different instances where the shows were like, you know what, let's have him on. Let's be fair. I mean, Scarborough, Waits Him Now, had Donald Trump on 1,000 times in a 2-month period. And Anthony Jeselnik, in an interview, he brought up the fact that Jimmy Fallon did the like
hair tussle.
The hair tussle.
And if you do it, I will just scream, John.
I didn't do it. Now, he doesn't think that Jimmy Fallon's really to blame for that. He thinks, again, it's actually Lorne Michaels who produced that show as well. And so, is Lorne Michaels effectively responsible?
So I would just say this: you like talking about this all the time. We kind of have this conversation about like
what?
Just finding the role of comedy in discourse.
Yes.
You come into it from a very like intellectual approach. It's like, does it actually do it? Because people ask these questions. Jeselnik is like such a great comedian in that every joke he writes is like the most specific turn of phrase. Mm-hmm. Like he gets himself into a corner and he's very bold and like very collected. And then he does like a half left turn that's just so precise that you're like, oh my God, you're a genius. You're a brilliant genius at writing comedic jokes. He's an SNL writer. He auditioned for, they were thinking when they replaced Cecily Strong on Weekend Update, they might just go with him alone. So he did that audition. And it would be great because he is just like this one like virtuoso type comedian. But his specificity on the Lorne Michaels thing is the way that that Fallon's show works, it's not political. The way that
it's
SNL,
the least political of all of
them. It's
those.
The least political. It's him playing games and being like, hey, and Jimmy Fallon did feel really bad after that.
Yeah, he did apologize. He apologized, yes. He said he never intended to normalize Trump and he felt depressed. He said, I made a mistake. I'm sorry if it made anyone mad. And looking back, I would do it differently. Look, I have heard that he's just not interested in politics or in it being a political show, which is fine. But it's why I'm less interested. I'm not interested in many of those shows, but I'm the least interested in his because I don't want to see John Krasinski play beer pong. Like, I just don't care
about
that.
But people do, and people
really
needed it.
Yeah, people do. It's popular. I get it.
People really needed it at that time when Fallon got his show. And it really did change everything. It made everything.
And it blew up.
Made it fun. But the SNL thing is what he seems to take issue with because SNL is a political show.
Yes.
Every single time. And he kind of mentions that they're buds, that Lorne Michaels and Trump are buds, and that it really did put him on this national stage that takes a show that does needle you, that goes after Trump, that had been going after Trump, and says, actually, it's okay, we didn't really mean
it. He's in on the joke.
And that's what's so good about Jeselnik is like he did a Trump roast. He performed at the Trump roast, and he's like, he's done a really good job. He's not afraid to, I think his joke was like, he's not afraid to like embarrass himself like on SNL or in the casino business. Like,
that's good.
Like that stuff where he is a very straight faced comedian that doesn't let you know ever, I'm just kidding, but he doesn't do that.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, where he takes issue, but I don't know for sure. And again, like, I think Jeselnik looks like a really insanely talented comedian.
Yeah. Look, I think that it's a fine, like, I don't actually think there's no one thing got him elected. Lots of things did. And my thing is, every like 6 weeks, people will attack Susan Sarandon on Twitter. And then 6 weeks later, people will attack Deborah Messing on Twitter. And it's like, want to know who's responsible for Donald Trump being president? Everyone in the country, because altogether we didn't do what was necessary to stop him. So I'm responsible, you're responsible, Skip, you're responsible. You watching, you're responsible. Not singularly, but we are all responsible. Now let's move on. But I do think that it was a really bad move by SNL to normalize him. I think that a lot of people do watch it. It implied that all of the weirdness that was Trump is not a thing that should scare you, it's a funny thing. And it's not a funny thing, or it's not primarily a funny thing at the very least.
Right.
And also pragmatically, considering how much their show was going to become mocking Trump, it was a horrible decision in that respect. Because I think it undercuts it to some extent.
In what way? What do you mean by it undercuts it?
Like, I think, so the idea that he is so important, what he's doing is so important, that they had, was it Alec Baldwin or whatever, who comes in constantly to do that one thing. Having him in just seems like the stakes are not that high.
For me,
it's just funny.
For me, it's that when you're doing a comedy show, your focus should be on revealing the truth. Mm-hmm. And that's it. Equal opportunity offender, whatever you want to call it. But when you have Trump on, your priority seems to be like being friends with him now.
Exactly.
And that's not okay. That's not truth.
Yeah.
That's an agenda.
And he's just attacked them constantly since then. Anyway, thank you so much, as always, for coming on the show.
Happy half hour.
Thank you, everybody, for watching all week. Happy half hour. We'll see you next week. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.